The subject, good morning, of this morning's Dharma talk is wise effort, also called right effort. In Pali, the language of the Buddha, the word that is translated into English as right is sama. So right effort is sama. I think it's pronounced vayama. And this meaning is associated with harmony and attunement. It's effort that is attuned with the reality of the circumstances and the abilities of the one who is making the effort. So don't be put off by the term right effort, thinking that you have two choices with effort, either to do it right or you are wrong. The application of effort to our practice is much more nuanced. In both Tewari, our co-guiding teacher, and Lindell, one of the other Sunday Sit teachers, last week pointed this out to us in their talks. I plan to talk more about this aspect of effort today because it's very important. As many of you know, we've been focusing on the Four Noble Truths this year. Wise effort, or right effort, is part of the Fourth Noble Truth that we call the Eightfold Path. And the Eightfold Path is divided into three groups: the Wisdom Group, the Ethical Conduct Group, and the Meditation Group. Wise effort, along with wise mindfulness and wise concentration, are the three components of that meditation group. And I'm sure all of you have experienced, or maybe it's just most of you, the need to apply effort in order to meditate. We have to break a pretty strong habit of not being mindful in order to meditate. Mindfulness goes against years of conditioning, which has taught us to think our way through life, So we have to learn how to see and answer the question, what's really going on here? Not just think about it. We can be grateful that the Buddha was practical and down to earth, and he didn't just hand out wisdom as a fait accompli, to believe as if it were dogma. He gives us a path of action we can follow, with the caveat, ehi pasiko, come and see for yourself. You have to try it out. The Buddha said that there were four purposes that we need to apply to our effort. He called them the four great endeavors. And these four kinds of actions are kind of grouped around the unwholesome and the wholesome. So unwholesome actions and unwholesome mind states require preventing if they are arising. So they're starting to arise and we want to restrain or prevent them. Or if they've already arisen, we have to abandon them, and that's renunciation. But then there are the wholesome states or the skillful states. So we want to maintain the ones that have arisen, which is like nurturing them, feeding them, beginning again if they start to wane, like we do in meditation when we've established mindfulness, but then it starts to go somewhere else. So that's, we got to go back, begin again. And then there's arousing wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And so that we really have to put some structure into cultivating or developing. So these four endeavors are important because they lead to the purification of the mind. And it is with the mind that we create the world. In the Rohutasa Sutta, the Buddha says, I tell you that there is no making an end of suffering and stress without reaching the end of the world. Yet it is within this fathom-long body with its perceptions and intellect that I declare that there is the world, the origination of the world, and the cessation of the world, and the path of practice leading to the cessation of the world. Another way of saying this comes from Bhikkhu Bodhi in his book, when he's talking on the Eightfold Path, when he's talking about restraining sense desire, he says, defilements lie in the mind, not in the sense organs or in the sensory objects. Mindfulness helps us restrain and abandon sense desire because it intercepts the process whereby the mind embellishes the sense object with qualities based on greed, aversion, and delusion. So we need to be able to discern in ourselves which states and actions are wholesome and which are unwholesome, which come from those poisons of greed, hatred, and delusion, and which do not, which are beneficial to ourselves and others. That is why we practice with the first, second, and third noble truths to help us do this. We learn that there's suffering. We learn to pay attention when we feel, this hurts, it's not enough. I'm feeling agitated, my body's tense. We might have a sense of, let me out of here. But we learn with the second noble truth that we have to stay with our stress in order to understand it. And we use the Buddha's instruction, ehipasiko, to see this for ourselves. So we start to investigate cause-effect relationships. You know, what's causing this pain and stress? And we learn to discern, does this action or mind state cause harm or not? Or why does it cause harm? How does it cause harm? All this takes a lot of effort. The Buddha helped us by identifying what he saw as the primary unwholesome states that cause stress and suffering. And these are the three poisons, as I've just mentioned, and it includes their subsidiaries, the five hindrances, which we become quite aware of when we start to meditate: desire, aversion, dullness and drowsiness, and doubt. We can look to the paramis for a start with, which we studied last year, for wholesome and skillful mind states and actions. And the 10 paramis, just to review, are generosity, ethical conduct, which includes the five precepts of right speech, right action, right livelihood, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right, I didn't write them down, what's the other one? Speech, action, livelihood, it'll come to me. So we also, in the paramis, have renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, kindness, equanimity. So these are the kinds of wholesome actions, some of them, that we can discern we want to cultivate and maintain. Also the seven factors of enlightenment and anything on the Eightfold Path are good sources of what do I want to cultivate and maintain. You can also discover skillful qualities that lead to long-term peace and contentment by just paying attention to your daily life experience. You don't have to use the list. I've noticed that making an effort to develop relaxation, for example, is very beneficial to me. So don't just rely on the lists, you know. Use your own ehipasiko, your own investigation. Now, wise effort to develop these qualities and abandon the ones that are unwholesome requires wisdom, not willpower. So let's return to the original source of the term, right? Effort, sama, vayama, meaning effort that is attuned or in harmony with what is the context of the situation, the reality of the situation, and the capabilities of the person who's applying the effort. So this also requires discernment, understanding the situation. It is effort that feels in harmony to the person who is applying it and in harmony with the aspiration of the person also. So we have to check. We have to check ourselves, check it out inside continually as we're applying effort. Given that it does feel right, the Buddha offered some strategies that could help a person abandon the unwholesome specifically, which to me feels the hardest thing to do. It's not easy to abandon bad habits, no matter how much we want to do so, and no matter how much we know how unwholesome the habit is. In Bhikkhu Bodhi's book, The Eightfold Path, he describes one such strategy that the Buddha offered, and it's called abandoning the arisen unwholesome state. The Buddha said that we can dispel an unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought, which is its exact opposite. He did caution that in order to be successful, we should make the wholesome thought or action a primary object of our attention, at least for a short time. This strategy can be applied to actions as well as to thoughts and mind states. For example, this is the strategy Tweri described in her talk Monday night, and some of you may have heard it, and some of you may have not. So I'm going to summarize it here. She noticed that she always wanted to get her way, and she didn't let other people get their way. She saw this as unwholesome, so I'm sure it caused her a lot of suffering. And she set a vow to practice not getting her way. Then she picked an action that was the wholesome opposite. She would practice being generous. And as an act of generosity, she would let the other person have their way. I remember hearing a talk by Joseph Goldstein, and I realize now that he was using the same strategy to help him overcome his habit of judging. He told, I think it was on a talk, or it might have been in one of his books. He said that he was on a silent retreat and was practicing being mindful by noting, which is a practice that is taught. And he noticed that he, as he silently watched others in the dining hall, he kept noting, judging, judging, judging. He kept finding fault with how others were moving through the food line, how they were eating, what they were wearing, etc. And he wanted to stop judging. He wanted to abandon it. He saw it as unwholesome. So the next time he went to the dining hall, he changed his noting word to a non-judgmental action, seeing, seeing, seeing. And he said that really helped him stop judging, because it forced him to do the opposite, just see, not adding any judgment to what he was seeing. You really should listen to Tweri's talk, because it's very entertaining, and it describes how she made the successful effort to abandon getting her way. But it loses something in my summary. Nevertheless, the elements are worth reviewing. The elements that she picked out, and I noticed them and took notes on them, because I am in the process of trying to abandon some unwholesome behaviors. So she said, pick a habit that causes you suffering and stress. And that could be a habit that shows up in your meditation practice, like one of the five hindrances, or it could be a habit that shows up in your relationships or your work life. It could apply to just one specific area of your life, or it could be more generalized. Then she said to resolve to abandon it. She chose a parami, but I've already talked about some of the sources of what you might choose to find, places to find wholesome goals, aspirations. Tuari then stressed that we must have some joy in our effort to abandon unskillful habits. And I noticed that I thought was pretty important, because that's one of the reasons I avoid abandoning an unskillful habit frequently, because it's associated to a lot of pain. So I don't feel joy when I start focusing on it. And because it's a habit, I've had a lot of failure with it. So that is not something I don't feel joyful about that. And I've tried before and not often succeeded. So for all these reasons, I find that I sometimes have trouble abandoning an unwholesome. So she says you have to add some joy and some positivity into this. And when she described her process, she said, one way you can do this is to tell yourself that you're going to fail some of the time, and it's okay. So failure's okay. Starting over is okay, she said. Obviously, I was thinking when she was describing this, patience is definitely needed. One of our paramis from last year that we talked about. So instead of giving up, we begin again. And it's kind of trial and error, which is what the Buddha talks about a lot. You've got to see for yourself. So you're going to have, if you're seeing for yourself, you're going to have trial and error. There's a sutta where the Buddha describes, he's asked a question, how do you cross the flood of habit and conditioning, which is pretty strong. And if you want to go in a different direction from habit and the flood, he said he did it by not staying in place and not pushing forward. He explained that when he stayed in place, he sank. So to me, that implies a sinking attitude, a lack of confidence or trust that patience and perseverance will work. Eventually, he said that when he pushed forward, he was whirled about. To me, that implies not being grounded or not being in tune with the intensity of effort needed. What caught my attention with Tuari's process was the stress she gave to dwelling on the feeling of well-being she experienced when she was generous and let her, which was her her wholesome quality that she was substituting every time she started to want to have her way and be greedy, have her way. So she said she would take time to dwell, is the word she used, on the feeling of well-being she experienced when she reflected on how she had been generous and let someone else have her way. And it's really worth listening to her talk, because you can see how well she felt. It's common knowledge that our mind has a negativity bias. We need to make sure that we counter that bias by paying more attention to what is good in us. And I recognize when Tuari was sharing this experience in her talk, boy, that's hard for me. I look at the thing that I'm doing wrong, that I need to abandon, rather than the little progress I make in doing something that is definitely feels gives me a deep feeling of well-being. So the unwholesome quality that I want to abandon is perfectionism and fault-finding in myself and others. And it's been a lifelong habit, and it's grounded in a lot of suffering and pain to myself. So I've been using some Parami cards that I acquired last year when we were using Ajahn Suchito's book on the Paramis. And when I was looking through the card from the Metta Parami jumped out at me. On that card, Ajahn Suchito wrote, "Recognizing the happiness of a warm heart, I aspire to cultivate empathy and compassion. Resisting mind states of fault-finding in myself and others, I encourage goodwill rather than ideals of perfection." That aspiration spoke to me, and I decided to memorize it and to say to myself at least once a day. And I put it on my kitchen table where I could see it easily and remember to say it. My experience with breaking habits is that after setting an intention, it helps to have some structures. The anchor we use when we meditate is one of these structures. Each time I say the first sentence of the Metta card, recognizing the happiness of a warm heart, I get a felt sense of a warm heart, and it feels good, and it reinforces my resolve, and it reminds me that yes, the happiness of a warm heart is the kind of happiness I want. There's an article by Thanissara Bhikkhu called Trading Candy for Gold. You can find it on Access to Insight, and it's about the effort involved in renunciation. He says, you gain a greater happiness by letting go of a lesser one. This Buddha said that before he became a Buddha, his heart did not leap up at the thought of renunciation, but he learned to let go of the happiness gained from pleasurable sense objects because he saw that there was another kind of happiness that was more enduring and involved a deeper peace. For example, Bhikkhu Bodhi describes right concentration in relationship to this thought, this idea. He says that concentration suffuses the body with a non-sensual rapture and pleasure that can help counteract any sense of deprivation in resisting sensual passions. When we cultivate wholesome actions in mind states like the Paramis or the Brahma Viharas, we give ourselves more opportunities to feel good about ourselves. There's a reason that the Paramis are called the Ten Perfections, and that they were essential to the Buddha becoming the Buddha over many lifetimes. And there's a reason that the Brahma Viharas translate as the divine abodes. So I'm resolving to make the effort to cultivate empathy and compassion and goodwill. And I'm making an effort to abandon fault finding in myself and abandon ideals of perfection. To put these into practice, I have to make them my own, which means I have to get in touch with my suffering from these, you know, what it feels like and how it arises in me and what the consequences are. And I have to tune the words so they are doable and make sense to me. So what abandoning ideals of perfection looks like to me? It looks like good enough is okay. Making mistakes is okay. Failure is okay. So this is a structure. I can say that to myself. I can pay attention when I do fail, when I do feel that I've made a mistake, and when I do feel that things are not enough. What I'm learning about wise effort is that changes don't happen overnight, but I need to show up and go through the motions even when at first they might feel a little hollow. Showing up means setting aside time in my day to remember to be present, and that's what sati, mindfulness, means. It means remember. So remember to be present to my intention and also set aside a little time to reflect. How is it going? And I've caught myself not reflecting on my good advances. I'll get to the, you know, I'll be walking in the door after a day and I'll think, oh, did I even remember, you know, being kind or not criticizing, you know, I got to make some time for that. Wiser effort takes a sensitive reading of what is called for and what one is capable of in the circumstances, and it's receptive, allowing whatever is needed to reveal itself. And I like the way my Qigong teacher puts it. When he is teaching us a new move, he says, have the intention, but don't make it happen. Another teacher of mine says, I recognize awareness, but I don't do it. I remember Ajahn Suchito saying what we need to do is to linger on our experiences. Unfortunately, I didn't remember which experiences and why we should linger on them. But when I heard Tori describe how she eventually abandoned the unwholesome habit of getting her way, I realized that the act of dwelling on her wholesome, generous intentions and acts were the same as the lingering that Ajahn Suchito was talking about. And I realized that in my beginning attempts to focus effort on abandoning fault-finding and perfectionism by cultivating goodwill and compassion, I started lingering on times during the day when I recognized that I was offering goodwill or compassion to myself or others, because I'd set that resolve, that intention. And I started noticing that there was some movement in that direction. I was paying more attention also to other people's goodwill and compassion toward me and toward others. And so that created a greater opportunity to just be aware and in the neighborhood of goodwill and compassion. So that was encouraging me in the right direction too. And it didn't take a lot of push, you know, it was being receptive. When I thought of these times, I recognized the happiness of a warm heart, and that gave me confidence and made me want to continue. And I began to see more and more the drawbacks of a cold heart toward myself and others. And I also noted that the cold heart towards myself was really the heart of it all. So here's the example. I'm just going to give you one situation where I applied it. My favorite real change vendor at my favorite local grocery store told me that she had to leave her spot because another real change vendor had been assigned that spot. She was pretty sad and a little angry about having to leave. When the new vendor showed up, I already did not like him. He was the intruder as far as I was concerned. But not only was he the intruder, outside of my awareness, I began to find many other things wrong with him. He played music that I didn't like, and he didn't smile, and he didn't look me in the eye. And he was a guy who had pushed out a woman, which is so typical in this economy. And I started to project stereotypes onto him. My prejudice was outside of my awareness at the time, and I just knew that I had placed him outside my heart. Fast forward many months, he started bringing his cat with him in a box with a blanket to work. In spite of myself, I realized that we had something in common, and I started talking to him about his cat. Everything changed. He loved that cat, and the cat loved him, I could tell. It never left his side, even though it wasn't restrained. He told me he had the cat for 10 years, that he had rescued it when it was a little tiny kitten. I was ashamed of myself, but in a good way. I really wanted to learn this lesson. Now when I see him, I get to feel good about myself and to feel the happiness of a warm heart and to remember that a warm heart is no small thing. I think the most important thing I'm learning about wise effort is how important setting a thoughtful intention is and how important it is to have confidence that there is cessation. We can abandon what is unskillful and causes suffering, and we can cultivate what is skillful or wholesome, which will eventually, to where I use that word many times, will eventually take the place of the unskillful, unwholesome. Following the Eightfold Path takes us to what is golden. How do you cross the flood? This is a poem. You cross calmly, one step at a time. It's from First Free Women. You cross calmly, one step at a time, feeling for stones. And the stones are like the suffering. How do you cross the flood, my heart? You cross calmly, one step at a time, or not at all. So just sit a moment. And now it's time, we have some time to discuss. And I thought we could talk about how you cross the flood of habit conditioning. How do you abandon what is unwholesome or cultivate what is wholesome? Just any, either one. And you can share any part of the process. Where do you start? What helps? What gets in the way? What do you want to abandon? What do you want to cultivate? Any of those topics. I guess I need to talk about effort too. Yeah, how do you apply the effort? That's part of the process. So it's 11:05 and we met in small groups last time. So I, since this is the second week we've talked about this, maybe we'll have an open discussion now. I'm sorry, did someone say something? Let's see. I got to get the whole screen up here to see everybody. So if you'd like to stay for the discussion, that would be great. And we already have Karen has her hand up. So Karen, do you want to unmute yourself?
Yes, thank you. I have a question. Tuari's talk was really amazing to remind yourself as you go of the connection or the kindness or the wholesome that you do, that you have to focus on that, because I've been having trouble finding joy in this practice. Wondering when it's going to come, but it has been. So there's like that little glimpse of hope, but I had to return to my job and there's this particular person that you're never enough. So I would really like it if you could repeat your metta card.
Where yes.
You're never enough. So you're going along and you're feeling good and you're being kind to your patients and you're trying to be kind to your coworkers. And there's this just pervasive feeling right now. And I'm not alone, but that you're not fast enough, mistakes. And of course, you know, the pressure of time and you're going to make mistakes. And so you have this, you're not enough. And I always thought myself so good, such a good nurse, a great nurse, actually. And everybody always wanted to work with me, but I don't want to be that anymore. I just want to be good enough. I want to do my job and I want to be kind, but I don't want that feeling of, I want to be the best nurse on this unit. And, but there's a particular, and I get pulled out of it so quickly. And then I get so angry at that particular individual. And then I lose it. I've like this past week of going back to work, I have a really hard time. And then I can totally see the separation of the feeling of kindness towards my coworkers and get lost in the difficulties of my patients, of being a patient and being worked on and the things that they're going through and how scared they might be. I get totally pulled out of that and I can see it. And then, you know, Tim made this idea because I mentioned it to him and I'm like, I like myself when I wasn't working. And now that I'm going back to work, I was afraid of it because it had happened once before within this past year. And he said, well, think about your feet, focus, because you don't have a moment to be like, okay, let's all be calm. Let's all take a minute now because Karen's lost her focus or my intent of right effort here. He's like, well, just take a moment to think of your feet. Or I said, I'd sometimes go to the bathroom and just take, not to be disrespectful to the practice, but that would be a moment where I can just sit and breathe to just take a minute without people wondering, is she stroking there? She's closing her eyes as she's stroking. But it's just that I get pulled out so easily and then I get so angry. I'm really having trouble just reconnecting. I'm like, I know I'm angry and I know I'm separated, but it's that, feel like it's an an uphill battle to get back to where I started at the beginning of the day. And it just, it's like a cake. It just, how do you get it back once it's lost? I really struggle with that in a high intensity environment and allow this one particular person to just, or a few people to suck that so fast. And I mean, I know it's a struggle. It's, it, you know, it's mine, but I just would love anybody's suggestion of that powerful emotion of anger. And I can see that disconnect, which I'm really grateful for. Like I was focusing that on this weekend, but I'm really grateful that I can see that disconnect. I just can't get it back, and I want it. So thank you.
No, thank you for sharing that, because it is good to see what it's like in the trenches, to remember that. And I actually have another situation where I'm not very successful at all. It's similar to yours in that I get angry because, yeah, I get angry and I can't change it. And so what I'm thinking is that, first of all, that's a lot of suffering. It really is suffering. And in the moment in the trenches, like you're talking about, that high pressure situation, if you are in tune with your capabilities, it is probably going to be really hard. You don't have a lot of capability to go to joy or, you know, well-being at that time. So I think assessing this, having your effort in tune with what kind of situation you're in that moment, is something. So something like something really expedient, like Tim said, just connecting with your feet. So if you can get in touch with some small piece, like you did going to the bathroom, that you can say that's good. You know, maybe that's enough. And then other work would be done away from the situation. So part of that other work, when you are at home on the weekend, whatever, that's when you work on, I think you have to go to the beginning of the Eightfold Path with the suffering and be able to be with the suffering and open to what you can learn from that suffering. You know, and I don't know what the answer is, because this is your seeing what it is, your investigation. But if there is suffering,
you need to be perfect. It's the need to be perfect, because then if you're perfect, then no matter what anybody says to you, they can't dent you.
Yes.
You know, so you think, oh, my game, and you know, I don't really care what you, because I know it. But now that I don't want to be that anymore, and I'm not trying to strive to be that, it seems like you're more dented. Like you're it's like being okay with not being perfect is a real self-esteem issue. You know, it's like you're either perfect or you're not.
It's really painful. So you have to be with that pain so that you can. That's my experience, is that that's one of the pieces of the work that I have to do, is I have to be with that pain of not being perfect. And so I have to carve out as much as I can, little pieces of time. But it's like two situations. You have the work where you're in the midst of it and you do need to go to the bathroom or, you know, identify with your feet. Maybe other people have some ideas of what you could do just to, you know, survive and prosper in your job. And then on the side, when you can be with yourself, you know, you can work on the suffering part and being with it and see what the next step is, because it does lead to cessation. You know, it is understanding and then cessation. So you're on the right track and more will be revealed. I don't have the answer, but maybe somebody else does. We've got four people with their hands raised, so they can share. Maybe you'll get some ideas from them, even while they're sharing, not necessarily directed to you. Judith, go ahead.
Thank you, Lauren. What I keep coming back to is the importance, the essential importance of right intention, just having the intention to liberate my mind and trying to keep it front and center. And then the also equal importance of patience, because I really recognize the be perfect thing. I've got that too. And I'm not in the thick of it anymore in the workspace because I'm retired, but it's still there, you know, this feeling that I have to fix myself and I have to do it now, you know, but I don't, and I can't. That's the thing. I can't do it right now. I can't fix everything right now. And just, you know, bringing myself back to that, that some patience is required. And that as long as I've got the intention to be mindful, you know, that keeps coming, but I need to relax into it. It's like if I'm grasping the perfection, it just, you know, it doesn't work. It just doesn't work. So anyway, and thanks for reviewing Tuari's talk. It was really, really excellent.
Thank you, Judith. Mm-hmm. Julie?
Hello. Oops, sorry about that. I really enjoyed the talk, Lauren, and I really appreciate the recap of Tuari's. I sat in on that. I was so glad that I did. And this business of finding joy, I find so interesting because there's a lot of the text, especially if you read through the Pali Canon, where it just, I personally don't think the joy aspect of it is emphasized enough for our Western minds. I feel like we're mostly all pretty bad at thinking we should be perfect. We're inundated with these ideals of, you know, we should have perfect conduct, perfect bodies, perfect, you know, perfect everything. It's not possible. There's no such thing as that. And yet we keep forgetting. I just wanted to apologies if it sounds like I'm telling everybody something they already know. I'm just kind of trying to remind myself as well. But Karen, I just wanted to say, I put my hand up as soon as you started talking because, I have a few things in my toolbox that have worked for me. not all the time, but they help sometimes. And, there is, you know, the compassion card, always, always. Oh gosh, that hurts. That hurts so bad that you're not this perfect person that doesn't exist. Oh, and you know what? That voice that just said, yeah, you idiot, of course there's no perfect person, that hurts too. You know, seeing the layers of beating up, not just the one on the top, but these subtle layers that to this mind is, you know, this is sort of conditioning that's been developed over a lifetime. We don't just have these voices in our head. We have voices that criticize the voices, that criticize the voices, that criticize the voices. And, you know, we can be mindful of one of them or maybe two of them, but at some point we start buying into it and they all hurt. I mean, in my experience. So the only tool that I wanted to share, two of them, one, yeah, absolutely the feet. To the Buddha did say in one of his suttas, pay attention to when you're sitting on the toilet. So there's nothing disrespectful about that if those were his words. And just the self-compassion has been just a game changer for me. So thank you. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you, Julie, so much. Candace.
Firstly, I wanted to thank you for the talk. It was just, I really like when you said we think we can think our way through everything, because it's so much of it is the heart. But I wanted to talk a little to Karen's situation, because I've been all about self-compassion this year. I've been taking a course in it. And one of the things that one of the teachers, I can't remember who it was, said was that sometimes we just need to step away from what's in us that's causing the pain and look at the person who's causing the pain. And first of all, offer them metta, because if they're causing this suffering, they are suffering. They're in pain about something. And it's not to analyze them about, you know, why they're in pain, but it's just to feel a little softening toward them, which is very kind for us in our pain, if we can feel a little softening toward the other person. And that has really helped me with a neighbor who is just difficult. Not in a cruel way, but just difficult and causes a lot of problems. And and my husband is amazed at how I sympathize with this person, because I've taken the time to think about where this might be coming from. And it's kind of hard to do in the moment, but you can sometimes do it afterward. I tend to do it a lot when I'm falling asleep at night. And I'm trying to, you know, lower the temperature. And my heart goes out to you. And I hope some of the stuff that we're all sharing with you, because we've all been there, may help.
Thank you so much, Candace. Nikhil? Or is it Lillian?
That's me. I just wanted to say that Karen, your sharing really resonated with me as well, because I think for me, I feel like the hardest place for me to like apply mindfulness and try to like work with things has been work. And I think for me, the reason has been because it feels like on the surface, work is pushing me in such a direction towards all the things I'm trying to move away from my mindfulness practice, in the sense of feeling this sense of rushing, feeling the sense of pressure, feeling kind of like all these things. I'm trying to cultivate the opposite of in my personal life. And so, I think it's just something that I'm constantly working with. And for me personally, I think one thing that's been helpful for me as I've been working with this is that disconnect that you mentioned of, you know, there's like, I can kind of see the truth of a situation. And then I can also like see the truth of like what I'm feeling, and like I can see that disconnect. And for me, what's been really helpful is realizing that it's not almost not even a disconnect. It's just two aspects of the truth that on the surface seem contradictory, but are really just like two truths of what are present at the moment. Where what's a truth is that I'm feeling this anger, I'm feeling this stress, I'm feeling anxiety, whatever I'm feeling. And I'm also able to see is like there's this truth of what the situation actually is. And I think sometimes for me, it feels like there's this pressure of what I'm feeling needs to correspond to what the truth is. And I think what's been helpful for me is when I'm able to see that that's not actually having to experience what the truth is or feel what the truth is, isn't actually the truth of that moment. And the truth of that moment for me is just that I'm feeling something. And there's also this truth about the reality. And over time, as I've been able to kind of just observe it and not necessarily try to force what I'm feeling to match the truth, what I'm feeling kind of just starts to lose its grip on me, because as the more I see what the truth of the reality is, the more I actually just naturally start to believe that. And I think one place where this has applied for me is where even when I'm done with work, I'm often just ruminating on what went on in the day and something that maybe I need to do, trying to solve a problem in my head, being frustrated about something that went on during the day, and my brain's just kind of like creating this stress and anxiety for me, and it feels like I'm on kind of like this like treadmill of my hamster wheel of anxiety. And as I've been able to start to kind of, for me, see this truth of I'm not actually solving anything when I'm doing this. I'm able to just start to, and just observe it, just observe, this is what's going on in my mind, and this is also the truth of what's present, that what's going on in my mind isn't actually helping anything, it's actually causing me suffering. I more and more start to actually feel that that's the truth. I start to just feel that as the truth, and what I'm trying to do in my head starts to feel like this like infinitely scalable wall that I can't scale, and I stop trying almost naturally. I don't try to stop trying, I just naturally stop trying. And so, I think just like, the more I've been starting to see that disconnect and notice it and just like kind of like realize that it's like not really disconnect, it's just like the truth. It's just the truth of that moment. That's been something that's really helped me.
Thank you, Nikhil. Thank you for all the wisdom, everybody. I want everybody to have a chance. Suze, and then Lyndall.
My perfectionism shows up differently. And Karen, thanks for being so real. I wanted to offer the strategy of humor and exaggerating the thoughts that come up, like, oh, I got this. Oh, aren't I just like so amazing? And do such an exaggerated thing with the thoughts in the mind that after a bit, I just see the absurdity of it. Not, you know, it doesn't replace, like Lauren was saying, when you're not at work and not in the pressure cooker and you kind of, you know, look at stuff. But in the moment, it has helped me a lot. Just bringing kind of, I grew up in a smartass family, and I'm just bringing that. I can hear all their voices. Well, aren't you just something else? You know, and whatever works for you, but humor can really help in the moment. It just kind of goes poof, you know, and anyway, I offer that because it's been really helpful to me. And hang in there, girl. And remember, every moment when you see and feel that you know what is going on, that is a moment of Dharma wisdom. That's a moment to celebrate. It doesn't feel good. We think joy has to be all, you know, peaches and cream. But the joy of the mind, seeing what's real in that moment, don't bypass it. It's important. It's important. And I encourage you to see that the importance of the Dharma wisdom, you're allowing yourself to feel what's really happening. Anyway, hang in there, girl.
Thank you, Suze. Lyndall, last person.
Oh, wow, so much. Yeah. There's so much to this. Well, Karen, thank you for sharing. This has just brought out all kinds of things. And I also have something to offer that's helped me a lot when I've been in the kind of a situation where I just feel like really overwhelmed, you know, by anger or grief or whatever. And I found that equanimity practice really helps me, you know, just kind of take sort of like when you kind of escape to the bathroom or something, but during that time, taking a little break and just sort of taking a deep breath and just acknowledging, this is the way it is right now. This is the way it is. Right now, I'm a hot mess and I'm full of all these difficult emotions and I don't know what to do. This is just the way it is right now. And just kind of just sit with that and not worry about how it ought to be better or ought to be different, but just sort of sit with that feeling. And that feeling kind of calms down and fades and something else takes its place for a while. And that really has really helped me to kind of get through the heat of that horrible feeling and recognize that it's just, this is the way it is right now and isn't always going to be that way. So I offer that as another strategy. Maybe it'll help.
Thank you, Lyndall. I would just like to offer a note of humor for you, Karen. The next time you're in the bathroom at work, you can imagine the Sangha with you, because what I've been noticing is we're all in this together. We're a whole Sangha of suffering from perfectionism and things, having difficulty with people in the workforce, and we're all there. So I would like to close with just the announcements that there's a medication.